Welcome back to the Bob Davis Podcast. This is the new talk. We are back from the road trip. Comfortable, I guess, in the studio. I'll talk about that in a second. Got the lights down low. And in this podcast, an announcement and some issue updates, as I promised I would do on things like Earth Day, city development, global warming predictions, buying food from the farmer's market, and finally, the media discovers the ravages of a slow growth economy. We're going to talk about all that. And oddly enough, it all fits together, so we'll talk about that stuff shortly. Well, I talk a lot about manufacturing on the Bob Davis Podcast, and one of the reasons is early on, Bachland R&D started sponsoring the Bob Davis Podcast, and I spent a lot of time talking to John and Tara Bachland about their company, about what they do, about their values, and then we started to develop a friendship, and it kind of led to more complex discussions of business and economics and, to a certain extent, politics, and it's been a great sort of collaboration. So let's talk about manufacturing and Bachland R&D. First of all, lots of developments at Bachland so far in the new year. So let me just tell you, if you're in manufacturing or you're interested in what Bachland does, or if you have a product to be manufactured, what you want to do first is to check out, after you hear this sort of endorsement on the Bob Davis Podcast, what you want to do is check out an updated, all new Bachland.com and see what they can show you. There are tons of links. There are tons of videos and information about what Bachland does. Also, check out the links to Tara Bachland's Healthy Life blog. The reason that is connected there at Bachland.com is because living healthy for all of Bachland's employees is central to the values for the company that we've discussed in some of the other podcasts. When I've gone out to speak at Bachland, I have also seen that in action. But the bottom line with Bachland, after you check out the website, is these things. And I think it's really important, especially if you're in manufacturing and you need products manufactured, you need people that are going to collaborate with you to create something really special. Wicked fast turnaround times, which is amazing for most clients. When they get the stuff back so quickly, they're pretty amazed with Bachland R&D. Innovative solutions, and I've talked about some of those, from the expandable collet pin to a work holding device to pre-production reviews for clients, as well as real client service in terms of taking care of clients. They're really doing a good job with that, and real resources about Bachland at Bachland.com. Contact Joe Dorn or Andy Bleck at Bachland.com and ask what they can do for you. Find out what these values can do for you or your company today. Energy, wisdom, knowledge, and imagination. That's what Bachland is all about. Bachlund.com, Bachland.com. And thanks, you guys, for sponsoring the Bob Davis Podcasts. First of all, an announcement. In my ongoing quest to find new sources of distribution for podcasts, for the Bob Davis Podcast, I'm announcing that the Bob Davis Podcasts are going to be available on Blog Talk Radio. In fact, as we speak, they are already available on Blog Talk Radio. I used to call Blog Talk the news talk ghetto because it was just, there were all sorts of crazy things in. And it's important. I've learned a couple of things about Blog Talk just in the last couple of weeks. They were the first in to provide some kind of a podcast platform that wasn't necessarily iTunes. And just recently, they've updated and changed their approach. Now they have high-quality podcasts like this one and many others. Plus, I have the option now of using the Blog Talk Live platform, which has always been kind of a cool thing about Blog Talk Radio, to do live shows if and when I choose. And then those shows would automatically be created into a podcast on Blog Talk Radio. So, should I ever decide to start doing live shows, the option exists. The thing that's interesting about this to me is, once again, you know, it's just another tool that broadcasters have that's that frees them from the vagaries of radio management. So, when someone like me is doing podcasts after being doing talk radio for years, here again, I could actually do a live show every day if I chose to on Blog Talk Radio. It would also be a podcast, just like it was on the radio, and you could call in every day and do all the same kinds of stuff. So you will eventually see a Blog Talk Radio player on the Bob Davis Podcasts website at thebobdavispodcast.com along that area where we've got iTunes and Stitcher and TuneIn and so forth, which we will still continue to distribute to. And you can listen to that, will take you directly to the Blog Talk Radio feed, and you can listen to the podcast there. And it will always play, I think, the latest podcast. But all, I don't know, I think there's at least 200 or so podcasts that are showing up there now. So check it out if you want at blogtalkradio.com, and you just search for Bob Davis and you can find it. So, you know, you can also continue to use iTunes or Stitcher or TuneIn or listen off the page at the Bob Davis Podcast. These are just other options. I will tell people that ads will precede the Blog Talk Radio stuff, just like YouTube, and follow it as well. And this is a way for me to send more, you know, podcasts out to a national audience and, more importantly, a national client base, which I think is going to help. One of the things I learned on the trip, it's really hard to get back in the studio you know, not be actually, I've got so used to being on the move and doing the podcasts in the podcast mobile command unit that it's just weird to be here. But one of the things I learned on the trip was that being untethered is really a cool thing, and being able to wander around the whole country is really a cool thing. And quite honestly, you know, the current iteration of the podcast mobile command unit, which is an ambulance, is only the first. You know, hopefully at some point I might just, you know, if I can get the right vehicle, I may just cut the tether completely and just wander, you know. You also might be hearing some endorsements for national clients during the podcast, which is going to be part of the Blog Talk Radio deal. I don't know if that's going to happen or not, but I want to welcome all the Blog Talk Radio members and everybody just listening to the Bob Davis podcasts on Blog Talk Radio. So, this Sunday in podcast time, April 22nd, is Earth Day. We have had several decades of policy based on various environmental ideas. Some have been good, some have been bad. I personally think mostly bad, despite what the EPA propaganda said this week. But certainly California, where I just spent 2 weeks touring the state, has its issues because environmental concerns have trumped better water diversion infrastructure. I heard a great one today. I couldn't believe this. California's Governor Jerry Brown is a big proponent, as you know, if you're living in California, of the high-speed rail for the state, which we have had all kinds of fights about rail here in Minnesota, and I could go, it's almost a whole podcast. If you really want to know more about it, listen to the Randall O'Toole podcasts going way back to last summer on the Bob Davis podcast, because Randall really wrote the book on the inefficiencies of this kind of transportation, and it's a huge controversy here. It's a huge controversy in any part of the country where they're trying to put it in. Bottom line is it's very expensive, and it doesn't move that many people. But listen to this. I read today that water desalinization, which would give California really unlimited fresh water for agriculture or other uses, and I always thought it was impossible. You know, I always thought desalinization was so expensive as to be impossible, but apparently Israel has perfected water desalinization as a way to irrigate crops. And so it would mean, you know, a lot of fresh water for agriculture or other uses. This water desalinization effort, at least initially, would be cheaper than the train the governor wants in California. So I think it's very interesting that if they wanted to solve the water problem out there, they could. And of course, Californians are talking about the fact that the state, because of concerns about something called smelt, is still dumping billions of gallons of fresh water into San Francisco Bay every year. Think about that in light of the current crisis and all of the rhetoric that's being spread around about drought in California, or really anywhere else for that matter. By the way, a smelt is a small silvery fish. I assume this is the smelt we're talking about, which apparently tastes much better than its name suggests, but I don't think that you're going to see a potentially extinct species on the menu at San Francisco's Tony restaurants. Maybe not. What else is going on? The U.S. government currently offers at least $7,500 in subsidy if you buy an electric car. Some states offer more. Just talking about California, they offer a great tax credit for people to buy electric cars. And so you do see electric cars out there because people have a lot of people out there have unlimited financial resources. But Even so, I love this story. At the prices charged a few months ago for gas, it would take 5 years for an owner to make up the difference in price between an electric and comparable gas model. These days, with gas even cheaper, it will take even longer. But get this, this is really important. People are trading in their electrics and buying bigger, badder SUVs because the price of gas continues to go down. 22% of those who traded their hybrid electrics traded them for SUVs, according to Edmunds. I didn't look deeply enough into the study to see if they're also trading for comparably sized small cars that are gas powered. But continuing along the government engineered market and development theory, and I love this subject. This is one of my favorite things to talk about. If you live in any American city in the country, major city, and really some small cities, you're confronted with something called smart growth. Usually it means walkable urban and close in suburban areas. It means new apartment construction, usually subsidized. They call it affordable housing, light rail, streetcar transit, roundabouts, all kinds of things that upset people. In some places, they're trying to get rid of cul-de-sacs, for example. The idea is to create hipster havens, which are places where they're populated by yoga studios, coffee houses, bars, antique shops, hair salons, and restaurants, where the so-called creative class and millennials will collaborate and thrive. And I've seen them most effectively in really early 20th, late 19th century cities, but just neighborhoods of those cities, like Chicago and San Francisco and parts of Los Angeles. It's really a 1950s kind of place. But these areas eventually divert hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars over the years to force people into early 20th century model downtowns, you know, which are fed by train lines and are supposed to be creating this creative class, which is a construct of a guy named Richard Florida. And it has never been substantiated that this so-called creative class actually creates jobs and a thriving metropolitan area. Still, you know, you go into downtown Chicago or parts of downtown Minneapolis and you talk about this thriving community, you know, in Minneapolis, I don't know, on the north side in Chicago, yeah, you know, but it's Chicago, it's 6.5 million people, or Brooklyn or New York, you know, in Soho, it's 15 million people. So the population concentrations, when you go into those areas, it belies the reality that there are huge suburbs and exurbs around those major cities where people never go into the downtowns. So if you want to create a hipster haven, you know, that's one thing. But, you know, is it efficient? And that's the other thing. And as I said, what ends up happening is hundreds of millions and billions of dollars over the years get, you know, diverted into these areas. Nobody really knows why. It just seems like a good idea. And who wants to live in the suburbs anyway? Well, that idea is now being challenged because, first, it has started that we are now starting to see growth in the so-called first ring suburbs. But now it's also happening in the exurbs as well. As millennials age and as successful older counterparts age, they are finding out that they want to move to rural settings or exurban settings where they can buy houses with land. So for the first time since the housing crisis of 2008, the exurbs and the suburbs are starting to grow again. And, you know, my thoughts on this are we're being told, and this is, I think, a major issue because this is one of the big progressive images, that we're going to create these thriving downtown areas and we're going to divert, you know, tax money and all sorts of resources, state aid and everything else into these areas, and we're going to feed them with trains, and somehow people are going to get on these trains, they're going to go downtown, and they're going to work. Well, the whole thing about technology today is it's not necessarily to work in the downtown area, and a lot of companies are closing their main offices in downtown areas, or they're downsizing in downtown areas because they simply don't need the space anymore, and it's starting to challenge this whole thing. And up until this point, they've been saying, well, millennials are going to populate these areas. They're different from baby boomers and Gen X, and they want to live in these downtown areas. Well, it may be that their flight to the suburbs and the exurbs was just simply delayed by the recession and the slow growth economy, which I'm going to talk about in a second. And you may start to see movement as the economy grows from these people to those parts of the areas, because it's hard to raise a kid in a condominium downtown, even if you love the coffee shops and the yoga places. The thing is, there's there's yoga places and coffee places and all sorts of things like that in the exurbs and the suburbs as well. And if they aren't there, they're going to be there as those areas grow. So it's just a very interesting thing because we've been told this model is the model for a long time, and I'm not sure it is. Final thoughts on Earth Day as we head into April 22nd. First of all, where is my list of predictions? All right, here it is. I think it was Ricochet put out a collection of predictions from 1970 on Earth Day on and around 1970, April 22nd of 1970, about what would happen in the future. And this is great because every year, this has become a secular Easter. That's what Earth Day is. It's essentially a pagan celebration of spring, renamed with a political message known, it's a secular Easter, okay? And as such, it's every Earth Day that comes around is filled with all sorts of prognostications about the future. And nobody ever checks back to record them or you know, talk about whether they ever came true. So here are 13 of the craziest ones that occurred in 1970. First of all, Harvard biologist George Wald said civilization will end within 15 to 30 years. Remember, this was back in 1970, unless immediate action is taken against problems facing mankind. You could have said that about any time in history. Two, we are in an environmental crisis which threatens the survival of this nation and the world as a suitable place for human habitation. That's Washington University biologist Barry Commoner. Three, man must stop pollution and conserve his resources, not merely to enhance existence, but to save the race from intolerable deterioration and possible extinction. That was the New York Times that said that in an editorial. Four, population will inevitably and completely outstrip whatever small increases in food supplies we make. The death rate will increase until at least 100 to 200 million people per year will be starving to death during the next 10 years. This was Stanford University biologist Paul Ehrlich, who has been proven wrong so many times, it's not even funny. He's still employed, as far as I know. Most of the people who are going to die in the greatest cataclysm in the history of man have already been born. By 1975, some experts feel that the food shortages will have escalated to the present level of world hunger and starvation into famines of unbelievable proportions. Other experts, more optimistic, think the ultimate food population collision will not occur until the decade of the 1980s. Another one from Ehrlich. I wrote next to that idiot. These guys just make crazy predictions. Six, it's already too late to avoid mass starvation. This was Dennis Hayes, the chief organizer for Earth Day. Here's the thing. What they couldn't predict was improvements in food production, and that's what prevented these mass starvations. Once again, it's the unpredictable, innovative nature of human beings that stave off these crises that these guys never predict. Seven, demographers agree almost unanimously. I love that because that's what we hear all the time about global warming. All the scientists agree, which is not true, by the way, but they agreed then in 1970 on the following grim timetable. By 1975, widespread famines will begin in India. These will spread by 1990 to include all of India, Pakistan, China, and the Near East and Africa. By the year 2000, or conceivably sooner, South and Central America will exist under famine conditions. By the year 2000, 30 years from now, the entire world, with the exception of Western Europe, North America, and Australia, will be in famine. That was from North Texas State University professor Peter Gunter. Again, completely false, and largely because of increased crop productions. And now they're telling us, well, that's not going to be enough, you know, so we can't support this many people on the planet. In a decade, urban dwellers will have to wear gas masks to survive air pollution. By 1985, air pollution will have reduced the amount of sunlight reaching the earth by one half. Life magazine. Nine, at the present rate of nitrogen buildup, it's only a matter of time before light will be filtered out of the atmosphere and none of our land will be usable. Ecologist Kenneth Watt. 10. Air pollution is certainly going to take hundreds of thousands of lives in the next few years alone. Another one from Paul Ehrlich. By the year 2000, If present trends continue, we will be using up crude oil at such a rate that there won't be any more crude oil. You'll drive up to the pump and say, fill her up, buddy, and he'll say, I'm very sorry, there isn't any. This was also from ecologist Kenneth Watt. And of course, we are now in the midst of a oil glut, so this is not happening. 12. One theory assumes that the Earth's cloud cover will continue to thicken as more dust, fumes, and water vapor are belched into the atmosphere by industrial smokestacks and jet planes. Screened from the sun's heat, the planet will cool, the water vapor will fall and freeze, and a new ice age will be born. Newsweek magazine. Well, that was that whole article from Newsweek in 1970 about the new ice age that was going to happen. That, of course, didn't happen. 13. And finally, the world has been chilling sharply for about 20 years. If present trends continue, the world will be about 4 degrees colder for the global mean temperature in 1990, but 11 degrees colder in the year 2000. This is about twice what it would take to put us into an ice age. Kenneth Watt. All of those predictions basically turned out to be, not even basically, they turned out to be hilariously wrong. And it's just, as I said, this is a pagan holiday. It is a celebration of spring, renamed with a political message, a secular Easter, and it's best to disregard most of the predictions that you'll hear. And lest you think that buying your groceries at the farmer's market is saving the environment, I found a study that shows that buying locally grown food can actually be worse for the environment. It has to do with transportation emissions being as much or lower for a truckload of kale rather than seven farmers bringing in their own load of kale in seven different pickup trucks. Basically, market efficiencies are better for the environment when it comes to farm-to-table stuff. And it might taste better for you, and it might make you feel better to go to the farmer's market on a Saturday morning, but you're not going to make the environment better. And people, I think, go to the farmer's market partially because it makes them feel better, but that they're doing something for the environment. As far as buying locally, I don't know if it makes any difference in the economy either. So, but I don't have a study on that, so I can't really speak to that. I'd like to know about that one too. Finally, I want to talk about the economy, speaking of, because I mentioned in one of the previous podcasts, in fact, I think it was the previous podcast, my frustration with media coverage of the 2016 campaign, which hasn't even started yet. And I think there's way too much focus on personalities. And the antidote for that is we really need to talk about five, maybe it's four, maybe it's six, I don't know, overarching issues that will drive the 2016 presidential campaign, whether they're talked about or not, because they're going to create conditions on the ground that will drive those campaigns. Any one of these areas could produce a crisis, which will make all the difference of the world. I've said that it's a dangerous time. I don't believe the Obama administration will end well for a lot of reasons, not the least of which is that we're at the end of an era politically, demographically, economically. We're at the end of an era of humanity, I believe. I'm not saying that humanity is dying. I'm saying that things are going to start changing really rapidly. And those of us alive in the current time frame are going to look back, whatever our age in 20 years, if we make it that far, and we're going to say, wow, things really changed after 2015 or 2010 or 2012 or whatever the watermark is. And the four areas or five areas I've identified are economics, foreign policy, social policy, and domestic policy. And almost every single driver of politics is going to come from one of those four or five areas. Here's the thing. Right now, everybody is telling people what they have to be thinking about. Right now, everybody's telling people to focus on Hillary Clinton or Marco Rubio or today's candidate in whatever end of the political spectrum they come from. And then when these guys start campaigning, they're going to be out telling people in the most banal language possible what they're supposed to be concerned about and what people want. And what has to happen is, if we're going to fix the political process, that has to come from the bottom up. We have to start generating an agenda on our own. And so to start that process, we have to start thinking about what we think individually, what you think individually is important, rather than this. Because as I said, if you use the theory of letting the crops lay fallow, the media doesn't let the crops lay fallow. They continue to sift and drill and sift and plow, and they're plowing the crops under year after year, and they're destroying the nutrients. So the people are just exhausted from this constant rehashing of the same crap from our politicians over and over again. And to defend the politicians, what would you have them do? I mean, if they go out and they speak plainly, they get into trouble. If they don't speak plainly, they get into trouble. So it's just one of those things where it's really a sticky wicket for these guys as well as for people. And it's because we're not generating our concerns up to project onto them. And I refuse to tell anyone what to do, in these podcasts. I think it's a huge mistake for commentators to tell people what we need to do, that we need to invade the Middle East, or we need to have this kind of, what I want to do is ask questions. And I want you to think about it. You know, we the people need to think about this stuff rather than let people who are in the public eye tell us what we're supposed to be thinking about. I think that's the thing that is really starting to bother me when you talk about the media valve that is wide open most of the time. And if you listen to people who do that, then you deserve whatever happens, because it prevents us from thinking for ourselves. So rather than talk about personalities and politics, which I could do, like it's Hollywood or sports, I'm going to do what I said I would, which is to give you some background. And in this particular moment, I want to talk about the economy a little bit, and not necessarily economics, but reporting on quote unquote this thing called the economy. So the media is finally realizing that the economy is not growing as much as they thought. They're asking questions like, well, where's the consumer? So, consumers aren't consuming their saving. This is after months and months and months and months prior to the recession and after the recession, of the media telling people they weren't saving enough. So now the people who heard that message stopped consuming and started saving. You might recall, people would say derisively, what did Bush do? Told people to go to the mall. And it was like, you're not supposed to consume because consumption is wrong. So that message finally sunk in. I've said this for years, and people stopped consuming as soon as they had an opportunity. And today, people are not consuming. And so what we have is low demand, and we have higher savings as people retrench. And I think also, based on what I've seen out there, I think people are adapting. I think they're adapting to a slow growth economy, and I think they're saving their money. I think they're being very careful with their money. If they have it, they're spending on things, obviously. But if they're quote unquote middle class, or if they're workers, they don't have the great jobs they had 10 years ago or 15 years ago. And so they're keeping their powder dry. And I don't blame them for doing that at all. Despite what the president and what the media keeps touting about unemployment, we're back to normal with unemployment. Well, we're not, because they're not including the long-term unemployed. And the fact that there's such a huge force of people out there that aren't working, and really it's just that they're not looking for jobs. That's really kind of what it means. They are essentially pushing down wages as well, despite what the authorities say. And artificial efforts to raise wages aren't working, because what is happening is that I believe you could say, well, we're going to raise minimum wages, and we do. But what happens is we get part-time jobs. And I think there's some evidence to suggest that that is what is happening. You can't blame it on the environment or some international crisis or a strike. In other words, they'll say, oh, it was the severe winter that we had out east. Well, it's a big country, and we had a mild winter in Minnesota, and we had a mild winter in the Midwest compared to what happened out east. The reality is that overcapacity is worldwide, and it's a problem in China, it's a problem in Asia, it's a problem in the United States, because part of it is, I think, we have overstimulated demand through quantitative easing and through all sorts of programs to give people tax benefits and targeting this and targeting that. Those things just don't work in terms of stimulating an economy, because they don't stimulate the supply side. And I think there is too much government spending going on still. And I think the so-called experts like Larry Summers and Hank Paulson, I guess they're experts, seem to continue to be suggesting for Keynesian spending solutions like spending on infrastructure, like building bullet trains. And what I see that is, I see that as malinvestment. I see that as diverting money to places that aren't necessarily efficient, the market wouldn't demand. Now, I am so tired of hearing about infrastructure, because I have been in I don't know how many major cities in the last month across this country, whether it is Oklahoma, whether it's Kansas City, whether it's Oklahoma City, whether it is San Francisco, whether it is, I'm trying to think of the town in Texas I went through, but I can't right now on such short notice. You know, San Francisco, Los Angeles, all over the country. I drove all over Los Angeles in two or three different vehicles, and I don't see where this terrible infrastructure problem exists. I see a lot of new roads, a lot of new overpasses, think Sepulveda in West Los Angeles, that are brand new, and I don't see what these guys are talking about, the quote unquote crumbling infrastructure of the United States. I see a lot of wind farms. I see a lot of solar. I see all sorts of building going on out there. So I'm not buying the infrastructure argument. So to put more money into infrastructure, and we put about the same amount, as a percentage of GDP into our infrastructure as any European country. So I don't think we have an infrastructure problem. I think the problem is we haven't stimulated the supply side. We're not creating business formation. We're choking business formation through, higher taxation and higher regulations and government involvement. It isn't gridlock. It isn't, they keep pointing to Congress. You'll hear even Hank Paulson, who supposedly is a Republican, which he's not, or supposedly a conservative, which I don't think he is, talks about gridlock in Washington. It's the trendy thing for these guys to say, well, it's gridlock. It's not gridlock. It's just we're just not doing the right things, and nobody knows what to do because there's no alternative plan from either party to what has become the norm in this country, which is to continue to make efforts to stimulate demand. And I would just simply ask, forget the Democrats for a second. If you're on the right, how many Republicans are proposing supply-side regimes? They're proposing tax cuts, but supply-side regimes also demand less regulation and significant cuts in budgets, not just tax cuts. And it seems like they're going out and talking about, we're going to cut taxes, we're going to eliminate the IRS, which is fine, but you're also going to have to cut budgets, substantially, to create the supply side growth that will lead to economic growth. So that's a key question for people who are watching the conservative side, and I don't expect any of those arguments to come from the Democrat side, because their solution is to spend more, borrow more, and to, have the state intervene more to quote-unquote solve these problems. The bottom line is that we are due for another recession. We have been in a very weak recovery for a long time, and the new recession will not be caused by the weather. Recessions are good because they burn out inefficient spending in companies, but apparently lately they don't seem to burn out inefficient spending by governments, and I think that's a real danger. Again, they continue to blame it on deflation, which is a podcast in itself, because I could use a little deflation in the meat department at Costco. But I'm still not seeing the new economic ideas that address the fears of trade, technology, and business in the future, and don't rehash old bromides from the faded Republican or Democrat, and that includes progressive playbook. So that's kind of my analysis of what's going on with the economy. I'll tell you that I believe either the economy or some foreign policy issue. Somebody just wrote a great piece about a potential war between Russia and the United States. Bigger wars have been started over smaller problems than the Ukraine or Crimea, or something involving the Middle East could end up being the primary issue in 2016. I don't know. If I had to place a bet, I would say it would be foreign policy, but it could be economic as well. So what I'm trying to do is give you some background instead of just rhetoric. Thanks to Bachland R&D for sponsoring the Bob Davis Podcast. Remember to check out Bachland.com, Bachlund.com. It'll tell you everything you need to know, really, about how great Bachland is and what they do. So check out the site. It's loaded with all kinds of information about how Bachland does what it does, and that will tell you a lot about Bachland if you're in the manufacturing business and looking to get something manufactured. And thanks again for sponsoring the Bob Davis Podcasts. Thanks to you guys that are listening on Blog Talk Radio, also Stitcher.com, iTunes, or TuneIn, and thank you for liking, sharing, and favoriting and following on social media like Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. I am BDavis7843 on Instagram. I love Instagram. And a quick note, Instagram is not Facebook, and it's not Twitter, and you're not supposed to make facetious comments. You're supposed to say, hey, that's a really cool picture of you and your husband in Los Angeles at the Wild game, or You're supposed to say, wow, that's amazing. You go, girl. You're not supposed to put snarky comments in there. But anyway, thanks for checking me out on Instagram. And thanks for your donations as well with the bright yellow secure and safe donate button at thebobdavispodcast.com. And thanks for you also for listening on the page to the Bob Davis Podcast at thebobdavispodcast.com. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye. Wow, I just realized I've got at least 5 Mad Men's to watch, so it's going to be a long night. Are we going to watch Mad Men? Awesome.
Some of y'all have never been down south too much. I'm going to tell you a little bit about this so that you understand what I'm talking about. Down there we have a plant that grows out in the woods and the fields. Looks something like a turnip green. Everybody calls it poke salad. Poke salad. Used to know a girl lived down there and she'd go out in the evenings and pick her a mess of it. Carry it home and cook it for supper. Cause that's about all they had to eat. They did all right.